Hello, and welcome to Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to break the taboos around death and dying and learn to talk about it. Thank you if you've been listening since the beginning, and if you have, you'll know we've covered so many aspects of death and dying, from what it's actually like to die, to how it feels to lose your nearest and dearest, the different ways grief can strike, the different ways we cope or don't with loss, how counselling can help, what part faith can play, how to help others going through grief, and how to pick up the pieces and rebuild a life after a big loss. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Nikki Paul, who has her own story to tell about her grief and loss. And her experience led her on to helping others. So I'd like to start, Nikki, by asking you to tell us about your story, really, how you got into all this work.
Thank you, Dillis, for having me on. Yeah, I think a lot of people working in grief, they do have their own kind of background that has led towards choosing this path. So looking back 5 years ago, my life was very different, and I was very happily married to a fantastic man called Fletch, and I guess I would consider that my life was on track, if that's such a thing. We were both doctors, and we had moved to the country to have more space for our children growing up. I was on maternity leave as our youngest was 3 months old. And 2 days after moving into what we thought was our forever home in the country, Fletch died in a car crash instantly driving to work. And yeah, it was obviously a very difficult time. My world as I knew it was really obliterated. And I think despite being a doctor and having that kind of exposure to how fragile life could be, it just had never occurred to me that something like that could happen to us. And, you know, at that stage, I didn't really recognize myself as a widow. That wasn't something that I knew could really happen to people with young families. And I felt incredibly alone and at sea, I guess. Our three children were very young, so we had a four-year-old, a two-year-old, and a three-month-old at the time, and really they were just amazing reasons to keep going and to keep functioning, and my driving force, I guess. So I very much concentrated on the children and what they needed, and tried to kind of stay strong and move forward. And despite my background as a doctor, I think that I still didn't understand at that stage, despite my husband having died, that grief wasn't something that you could fix, really, that it was something that I was going to have to really come to some form of acceptance. So I think right at the beginning I was looking to be fixed and very much distracting myself from everything that was going on by keeping busy. And it's very easy with, you know, three children under five to keep yourself busy. So yes, I took much time off work as I could. I did get some counselling, and you know, maybe that was useful, maybe it wasn't. It's so hard to know when you don't know how you should be feeling. And eventually, it was probably about 15 months after he died that I returned to work as a paediatrician, which was another way of keeping very busy and not necessarily having to think about things so much, and just trying to sort of, you know, keep strong. And I think it was a very long time until I really learned more about grief and understood more about grief, that I came to a stage where I accepted my grief more. And part of my process with that was probably discovered accidentally, actually. By I've always been somebody that's been up for a new challenge, and one of my friends, who's also a doctor, introduced me to life coaching. And I think it was something that I was keen to learn and incorporate into my work. But actually, in the process of learning to coach, got exposed to being coached myself. And it was at that stage, thinking about what was important for me in my life now, that I started to really process my grief and move forwards.
That's a very clear explanation. Thank you for that. And I'm so sorry about your loss. And I can see that even 5 years on, you're still very moved when you talk about it, aren't you? It's raw.
Yes. And, you know, I think that we almost think that it shouldn't be. And that's kind of a problem with society and how we are taught to deal with grief. And we are kind of brought up with an understanding that time heals, and time doesn't heal. If you were, you know, if I had been in a coma for 2 years after he died and I'd woken up, my grief would be no different to right at the beginning. It's the work that you do that requires time that can make a difference. And so, yes, I think it will always be raw. And that there were times where I would have made an effort to hide my emotions, because obviously publicly being upset and expressing that, it makes people uncomfortable, grief. And so, you know, being a good member of society, you don't want to make other people uncomfortable. So you mask it. But that takes a lot of energy, not being true to your feelings. And so it's something that I am getting better at accepting, that yes, it was a horrible thing to happen. It is always going to be upsetting.
And such a big shock, because there you were busily leading a normal life one day and suddenly the next everything's changed just overnight.
Yeah. I think modern society tries to convince us that you know, that those kind of things can't happen and that it's fundamentally wrong, but actually grief and loss are very kind of natural processes, aren't they? And we all are vulnerable to it. But I think if we realized how vulnerable we were to these kind of things happening, it would really limit your ability to function. And so part of the way that you function is you think that life isn't that precarious. But yes, when your husband dies driving to work, you realize actually it is precarious, and that's part of what makes it so special and precious.
And it's such a tragedy that we don't allow our vulnerability to show, isn't it, that we think we have to mask it, to use your expression, because we could do so much more to help the bereaved, really, couldn't we?
Yes. And I think grief just is one of those things, and you know, I was 100% guilty of this myself, of not really, you don't know what to say when someone has suffered a bereavement, and you think that it's not necessarily good if you upset them about it. And obviously that leads to people ignoring it and just forces people to mask things, and also just choose to not put themselves into situations where they have to interact with other people. And, you know, as I'm sure you've experienced, grief is a very lonely place to be. And actually, one of the things that helps with grief is getting out there and feeling part of a community and feeling heard. And so this kind of a need to act and pretend to be polite that everything's okay when clearly it isn't is very tricky, because it kind of forces people to isolate themselves even more, from my experience.
Or if you do go out and about and interact with people, it can be very hard work.
Yeah, it's absolutely exhausting to spend your time thinking about or just pretending to be something that you're not feeling. And, you know, grief has many physical effects as well. And, you know, exhaustion is one of them. But I think that that's probably a lot of that comes from that having to pretend that things are okay. And obviously it's nice sometimes to have moments when you're not dwelling on it and everything, but just that constant kind of performance is really tricky.
Do you find, in your contact with people, and we'll come on to more about your work in a minute, but do you find that people do often then enter into a kind of downward spiral where they don't want to go out and about, they do isolate themselves, and then of course they feel worse and worse and worse?
Yes, no, I do. And I think one of the things that most of the people that I know who have been widowed have found really helpful is to find their tribe, their people that understand them, that maybe have been through something very similar themselves. And personally, I found a charity, Widowed and Young, which is a UK-based charity that supports widows who they consider young, less than 51 years of age when their person died. And it offers peer support, essentially. And finding people in a similar, but all kind of grief journeys are unique, aren't they? But similar situations, so that they have some kind of understanding and context about things that are difficult, that just wouldn't occur to somebody that hasn't been through this, it is incredibly helpful. And it's often through finding their tribe and having support from that people, you know, start re-engaging.
Can you think of some examples of things that other people wouldn't have thought about?
So I mean, there have been many, many examples, but I suppose recent ones that I still find very tricky are parents' evening and doing that without Fletch. You know, even 5 years down the line, it always brings up emotions, because it's one of those occasions where everyone else is doing, well, not everyone, all families are different, aren't they? But you perceive everyone else to be doing it with an interested father figure who also, you know, has a vested interest in this child. And so, yeah, I don't think most people would think that parents' evening is a tricky time, but I find that. And, you know, so happy times as well can be quite tricky. I'm trying to think of an example. So, you know, just things that you know they would have loved and they're not here to see, I personally find difficult. And yet they can be such lovely times. So, you know, my daughter winning an award at her rugby club, you know, my husband Fletch, he loved rugby and playing rugby, and he'd introduced our oldest to the rugby club a couple of months before he died. And, you know, for him to see all three of them playing at the club, and then yes, my daughter getting an award, I know he would have loved that. Yeah.
Kind of bittersweet, isn't it?
Yeah, bittersweet is a very good way of putting it.
So would you like to tell me then how you got into helping other widows?
Yeah, no, so I think I had already, through the kind of tribe kind of aspect that I'm talking about, had already along my path come across a number of widows who we kind of supported each other. And then it's one of those things that, you know, before my husband died, I didn't really come across any widows. But then afterwards, you find them everywhere. And it's amazing. But just supporting friends initially, or widows who became friends and kind of supporting them through the process, and actually, you know, sometimes being just that little bit further down the line with a slightly different perspective. I think I sort of informally started supporting people, and then when I learned how to coach and realized how useful it was for me on a personal level, I then also did some training in grief, which was also really helpful for me, but started coaching mainly widowed mums, but there's a whole, you know, whole kind of group out there who've been affected by grief in different ways. And I think it was really widowed mums because that's who I identify with. And, you know, I still remember looking back at, you know, the early days when I was reaching out for help and not really finding much. And, you know, there are different charities out there that support people in different ways. And, you know, as I said, I 100% recommend WAY for people. But in terms of that kind of individualized support, I do remember reaching out for help, probably through charities for the children. And, you know, then they would hear how old my children were and be like, oh, well, you know, they're a bit young. What we recommend is supporting the carer. And it's like, well, their daddy's dead, so I'm the carer now. What can you offer me? And then not, you know, they'll be like, oh no, we support the children, and, you know, just not getting anywhere. And then, you know, I think it also depends how your person died as well as to how much support is out there. And, you know, Fletch wasn't in a hospice, so I didn't have any of the access to those kind of services. And he didn't die from cancer, because that's another one where, you know, there are things out there. And so I very much felt alone. And, you know, I was recommended some counselling through the practitioners service, and actually kind of started, you know, the process with going down that, to only find that no, grief is a normal process, and they couldn't support that. And so I just, you know, I remember reaching out a number of different times for support, and just not really feeling that it was available. And so ending up really with this kind of peer support network that was incredibly helpful. But it just made me realize that having somebody to turn to in terms of thinking about processing your grief, but also how you want to rebuild your life, I would have absolutely loved to have found somebody who understood grief. And from my experience, that really has to be someone that has been exposed to it, to have essentially walked alongside me during that time. And that's really what led me to go down this route. And I'm finding it incredibly therapeutic and incredibly rewarding to be able to help, you know, mainly widowed mums along their journey.
So what is the greatest need amongst all these people? I mean, I, from what you've just said, the greatest need is when you reach out, having somebody there, isn't it? And that's what you're providing. But it does seem extraordinary to me that in this day and age of the internet, there isn't more support out there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there are clearly therapy is available and you know, widely available, especially, you know, with Zoom and things like that. When I sort of also looked for counsellors, I kind of wanted somebody that I thought would specialise in grief. And actually, when I looked into it, and I did eventually find a wonderful therapist who has been much support to me over the years, but they all had sort of, you know, 20 different things on their website that they could help you with. And I was looking for somebody that was a kind of expert in what I was going through, and maybe be prepared to sort of say that they had some personal experience of a profound loss. Somebody that really got grief who could guide you through it.
So tell me now about the people who come to you and the kind of help you offer them, because obviously you are now exemplifying what you were looking for, aren't you?
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's a bit of a range. And I actually think that some of the people that I help are actually through social media and the things that I post and I get comments on and messages about, people that are grieving, you know, for all different kinds of losses, and even, you know, pet loss, I think, is underestimated. And so actually just part of what I do is trying to educate the general public about grief and its impact, and how to approach somebody that's grieving, how not to approach someone that's grieving, and just really trying to understand and get rid of some of these myths that, you know, just aren't true, like time heals. And so part of that, I think, is some sort of education, but also understanding that I'm trying to put out there on social media. And then I do have my clients that I work on a one-to-one basis with. And that is very much allowing them to tell their story, because there's something very therapeutic, you know, even here today, about telling my story and what you know, we have been through. So that's part of it. But then also looking at, with this massive change that has happened in their life, what do they want from their life now, and what are their values, what is important to them, and then really breaking it down into small steps so that they can move towards that.
So I'm guessing you have people come to you at all stages in their grief journey, do you?
Yes, no, definitely, Dillis. And I think that even with my experience and knowledge, I have been surprised that many, many years down the line, people are still reaching out for help. And it always comes with it's really silly because I'm 10 years down the line. And you're like, no, it's not. Because, you know, part of how people function with grief is, you know, putting it in a box and shutting the lids and not going there. And as you know, they're triggers all the time, aren't there? And so every so often they come up, and it's then that they realize, I haven't really processed this. So it's never too late to actually do this work. And I think there might be a time where it is too early, but that's very much the very acute stages of grief. And actually, usually at that stage, people aren't at a point where they're reaching out.
Is that the theory behind the argument that you shouldn't counsel for grief because grief is a natural process? You alluded to that earlier on, didn't you? I know that there is a theory that, well, there used to be, I'm not sure whether it's still current, that counselling was not appropriate for grief because it was something you had to go through.
Yeah, and you know, that's certainly something I was told when I was put on a waiting list that was going to be a very long time anyway. It was, oh, well, you know, it would be too early for you anyway. So I'm talking more about brain fog, and I don't know how you found it. And obviously I also had a small baby, so I was a bit sleep deprived as well. But certainly, you know, initially I couldn't, you know, reading a magazine article would have been a bit of a challenge, kind of brain fog. So, you know, I think if you're not managing to look after yourself enough to kind of get washed and showered and function on a basic level, then you wouldn't be at a stage where grief coaching was helpful. I'm not sure that 6 months, I wouldn't say that there isn't a timeline for grief, is there? It's so variable for everybody and their different circumstances, how they respond to it. But I think it's more, there's a learning process to grief that you have to overcome. So rationally, you might know that your person's died, but when you have automatic sort of processing of your brain, and so there might be certain things that when you get a certain time of day and you hear the car pull up, you expect to see your person because that's what would happen. But that automatic thinking is faster than your higher level thinking that knows your person has died. And so you get that kind of hit of thinking that your person is going to be coming through the door, even though you know that they're dead. And that automatic habit thinking has evolved over a number of years, and that thinking takes longer to kind of get through, because your brain has to essentially rewire that is not happening. But I think the only reason for kind of leaving things longer are the brain fog and really if you're not functioning on that level, and then maybe even some form of counselling would be more appropriate at that stage. But grief coaching is a lot more forward focused and thinking about what you want from the future.
So tell me more about that then. What kind of things do people want from you?
So, and that's one of the interesting things about coaching, is it's different with everybody, and it's very much led by what the client wants and what they want to explore. But there are certain sort of exercises we can do, thinking about what's important to them, what their actual values are, and thinking about what you enjoy in life and what energizes you and your priorities are, can be extremely helpful for then creating the life around that honors that. And part of it is also thinking about how you honor the person that has died as well, and continue to do that in the future.
You mentioned earlier on how you feel part of your role is to educate society about how to deal with the bereaved. What is the word that you want to spread out there, really?
I think it's thinking about those kind of grief myths that are out there that aren't true. So one of the ones is the idea that time heals, as I've said, and just really understanding that there is no timeline for grief. It's different for everyone according to the situation that they've been in. But also, I still don't think that people who haven't been exposed to grief themselves generally understand that 25 years down the line, things are still, it's still appropriate to grieve. Hopefully your grief would have moved on from the very kind of overwhelming acute grief, but it is still normal for that event to have had a significant impact. So the kind of the time, the kind of myth about staying strong and stay strong for the children is a common one that my widowed mums get. And it is, you do need to be functioning, feeding them, getting them to school, those kind of things. So yes, there is an element of that. But actually, staying strong and, maybe sometimes not talking about the person that's died, or pretending that it's all okay to the children, and, not showing emotions about the children is really not modelling a healthy way of processing your grief. So I think that one is quite important. There are many grief myths out there, and the keeping busy And, you know, people really encourage you to keep busy and not think about things, because obviously time will heal. And so you'll be better in a while. So you might as well just get on with it. I think that's definitely another one that comes up. There's also replace the loss. You know, I had a, oh, don't worry, dear, you're young, you'll find someone else, you know, and I don't find that a very helpful grief myth out there, that, you know, lose something, oh, just replace it. And yeah, I think there are many, many ways that we could improve things. And I think there is just that fear of grief and being afraid of getting it wrong. And I totally am guilty of that. So rather than risking getting it wrong, upsetting somebody, it seems sometimes easier to avoid them. And actually, even just saying, I really don't know what to say, you know, I can't imagine what you're going through, those kind of things, and being honest about the situation are probably preferable. And you know, even that is quite difficult. But I think if someone said that, as opposed to how are you doing, because that's a very tricky one, isn't it? Because how are you doing? How should you be doing? You know, does this person actually want to know how you're doing, or is it just that flippant kind of greeting? So yeah, I you know, it is very tricky knowing the right thing to do to help people that have been bereaved. But I think just taking some of the kind of fear of it away would be helpful. And I think if we understand things, we're generally a lot less afraid of them. So just, I think, being open about my story and what comes up for me in social media seems to be helping people.
Because they're not used to seeing people being as open as you are.
It's showing your vulnerability, isn't it, when you're talking about very personal things that have been extremely upsetting. So yeah, I think just triggering conversations and highlighting situations is helpful.
There's a huge learning curve, really, isn't there, to be learned, really, by the whole of society about how to deal with this. And we're taking little baby steps along the way, I suppose, aren't we?
Yes, definitely. And I think your podcast helps with that, really, doesn't it, to kind of get the message out there. And because it's not only by directly helping those widowed mums that I work with, but also, you know, indirectly the people that they come into contact with.
Fascinating. Thank you ever so much, Nikki, for talking to me and sharing your experience and your expertise.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.